Senator Hessman, please come to order. Let the record show that Senator Paul Fisher, Senator Joe Joseph, and myself present, and would you please note the others as they come in? I know that we have some very busy schedules today. The first bill before us today will be Senate Bill 45, and since the sponsor is not here, we'll ask Dennis DeWitt of the Alaska Hospital Association to proceed and then interrupt when she is available. Dennis?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Committee. I'm Dennis DeWitt. I'm President of the Alaska State Hospital Association. Senate Bill 45, which is before you, is a bill which we've had great interest in. The purpose of the bill is to permit Alaska to accept the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Hospital Survey in lieu of the licensure survey performed by the state of Alaska. There are approximately, in the United States, 40 other states which already do this. However, under our statute, it specifically requires the state to perform annual audits and licensing surveys of hospitals and nursing homes. We've suggested not only the bill, but also an amendment, and I believe the committee has copies of the proposed amendment, to delete the word annual from the statute and to also include the department may accept accreditation by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals in lieu of its own inspection. The reason that we're proposing this change in the printed bill is that we discovered that while we understood what the bill said and meant, and while the Department of Health and Social Services understood what the bill meant and intended and would allow, neither Bob Ogden nor I, who both understood it, might be around forever. So I thought we would clarify that issue. There are substantial licensure statutes and regulations, all of which I could reference for you or we could walk through. Additionally, I have the accreditation manuals with me, which show those kinds of things that the Joint Commission looks for in its survey. I'd point out also that both the federal Medicare program and the state and federal Medicaid program accept the Joint Commission on Accreditation survey as the accreditation and survey process in terms of determining whether or not a facility is eligible to participate in those two federal programs. The licensure issue and survey issue is driven somewhat by the federal government. There are federal funds for it. And so I think the notion that the federal government will accept this and has in 40 other states speaks strongly towards what we're doing. We also believe that there are significant cost savings effects that this bill will offer, both for the institution in terms of not have those that choose to be accredited by the Joint Commission, but not have to sustain two surveys in the year that the Joint Commission is there, which they do now. And in terms of the state would not have to survey at least in the year that the Joint Commission comes in and surveys those institutions that choose to be accredited by the Joint Commission. Currently, accredited institutions in this state are Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Humana Hospital, Providence Hospital, Norton Sound Hospital, all of the Indian Health Service hospitals, Sitka Community Hospital.
How about Bartlett?
Bartlett is not currently. And I believe, have you applied? Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna is in the process of applying and will go through the process. It's our judgment they will also receive accreditation. There are a number out there. South Peninsula Hospital in Homer has indicated interest in becoming Joint Commission accredited, as have a number of other hospitals.
What are the advantages or disadvantages to being accredited?
We believe that the survey is it's a good marketing tool in terms of quality of care. It's it's an accepted survey nationally. It allows judgment against peers on not only a statewide but a national basis. It started out as a self-policing process. It's now a separate corporation independent of both the American Hospital Association, American Medical Association, and it is a very good judge of quality. It's well accepted nationally. And I think the importance in terms of Alaskan facilities over the last 5 years, particularly that I've been here, is that it's a mark that we can look to with reference to the improved quality of care and the excellence of care that is, in fact, here in Alaska. And we're not what some folks would like to say about our healthcare delivery system. So it's a standard against which you can be judged nationally in terms of your quality.
Are there questions on the part of other committee members?
Yes,
Senator Josephson.
Let me ask you two things. First, is there anything lost in respect to quality by the fact that the inspections would no longer be annual? How often would the joint credentialing group be visiting hospitals?
Currently, the Joint Commission is on a 3-year cycle with an 18-month self-assessment that you need to go through, which is not a survey. It's the judgment of those states and the Joint Commission that participate that quality has not been jeopardized. As I said, there are 40 other states that do this. My understanding is that the process that the department will move into, and this legislation does not mandate that they go to a 3-year cycle. It's my understanding that the first round or so, what they'll do is simply not survey the 1 year that the Joint Commission is there, assess the impact, and then if you can move to perhaps once every 3 years, the Joint Commission in, once every 3 years, the states in, that gives you a surveying every 18 months. You can monitor that, and then perhaps move to the 3-year based on an analysis that, in fact, the quality is maintained.
Are there issues of liability that arise if there's a deficiency in care or a suit brought against the hospital? Is there an issue of liability as applied to the state government?
To the best of my knowledge, Senator Josephson, there has been no litigation in that area.
I could be wrong, but hold that question for the State Department.
I do not believe that to be the case in my discussions with either the Joint Commission or my colleagues in other state hospital associations.
Were there further questions or comments on part of the committee? I have some questions, Dennis, but I think I'll hold those for the department and see where we come out on that. Thank you very much,
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Faison, she's
been notified.
Then, while we await the sponsor of the bill, we'll ask the department if they would like to testify on Bob Ogden.
Senator, if I can, committee members. My name is Bob Ogden. I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Medical Assistance. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 45. Senate Bill 45 is our kind of image of efficiency in government this year. It's a way that we, the department, can somewhat control our resources and be able to survey all the facilities that we have to survey now, that currently we're having a very difficult time doing surveying, while at the same time, we believe, maintaining the quality of care in the facility.
How do you feel, sir, about the proposed amendment?
The proposed amendment is we're in favor of. In fact, we participated in asking for it. The reason that we wanted the amendment is that just taking out annual did leave it, you know, open as to interpretation of what the department might be doing. And we really only wanted the flexibility to apply to JCHA accreditation. I would like to say to you that we have no plans to back away from surveying hospitals just because the JCHA is in there. We hope to be able to, the first year, participate along with the JCHA in their survey. And then, depending upon the outcome of that survey, determine when we will next go into the facility. Facility by facility. We feel that we should only go into those facilities that have problems, not those that from year to year have a good standard, and we still have to go in anyhow just because the statute requires us to go into it.
That brings a question to mind that that I had a while ago. We make inspections then annually now, right?
Yes, correct.
And that's due to the way the statute's written?
Yes.
Well, I think you're wise to clarify this because we've had some examples in other committees of literal interpretations of legislation that where people do not understand the intent of the legislation. I'm glad you made that clear, both you and Dennison, in the recommended amendment. Yes, Senator Sturgeon.
Through the chair, if I might, Mr. Ogden, a couple of things. I certainly can understand the idea of not going every year. Now, but I do have some concern even with the proposed committee substitute and would like to run something by you. A list of hospitals was given that is covered by the Joint Commission on Accreditation. There are hospitals, am I not correct, that are not covered by that. And they would tend to be the smaller facilities, is that correct?
That's correct.
I guess taking away an annual inspection, which I'm sure has created some real resource problems, is a good thing. But I think we can see with just where the revenues are that we're going to continue to find, you're going to have continued problems even at a lesser level to keep that up. And what I'd like to know is, you said that you would visit those areas that had with the Joint Commission and determine when you should be going back. What about those smaller hospitals that may have more problems simply because they're having financial difficulties too? How can we be assured that they're getting an adequate level of protection? Before we were saying too much, now we're saying very little. And I'd like to know whether by regulation, by some particular process, that we can be assured that with your limited resources, you're going to be doing the kind of inspection that you should. And this bill doesn't tell you what that is.
No, we would immediately go into a regulatory process where we would put before the public regulations that, at least in my opinion, right now would say that we have the authority to go into those facilities annually, whether the JCHA was in there or not. And that those facilities that are not JCHA accredited, we would be into annually.
Madam Chair, that you see, that's the question. There are the two levels here. The one where we have the larger facilities where we have the joint accreditation. And it is foolish to do that twice because you have somewhat different standards and interpretation and people. And that just makes good sense to mm-hmm. coordinate those. But it's the other ones that
those,
are not covered.
Those other smaller ones,
that
Senator, we would be into every year.
But we're not saying that.
Well, but where regulation...
Are your regulations saying that now?
No, they do not say that. See, the statute says that now, so we don't have to put it in regulation.
Well, now you're confusing me. If we remove this annual then, I thought this annual removing was only in those areas where the accreditation team came in.
No, what it does is takes away the annual totally and leaves the flexibility to the department to put in its regulations how often it will be in facilities.
How often is there not a federal requirement on that level?
There's all kinds of federal requirements. That's one of the things I'm glad you asked me that, because I'd like to get into all the other reasons we're in facilities. The certification and licensing section certifies facilities for Medicare and Medicaid. That's a total separate process. We license facilities for state purposes, and we do inspection of care for long-term care purposes. So we're in those facilities for three separate purposes. In all cases of long-term care services, we have to do the inspection of care annually. That's a federal requirement. We have to see 100% of the patients in those facilities. Most all of our small hospitals or facilities in the state are what we call combination facilities. They're hospitals and long-term care facilities. So we're going to be in that facility annually, whether they're JCHA accredited or not, for the inspection of care purposes. And we probably would be in there annually for the hospital inspection for licensure purposes if they're not JCHA accredited. And what we're trying to do with this bill is make it so that we can take our certification and licensing survey personnel, send them into a facility once, and do everything at one time, and bother the facility once that year instead of three times. And then in those cases where it is a JCHA accredited facility, after we've reviewed the JCHA accreditation's report and found that we think the facility is in good shape, have the flexibility to say, okay, this year we won't go into that facility for licensure and certification purposes only. We would be in that facility for inspection of care purposes on long-term care.
Madam Chair? I have absolutely no... I think that's wise to give them the flexibility, but it just seems to me that leaves a hole. They're talking about doing it by regulation, and I'm just wondering if a letter of intent along with that, it's, again, I can see exactly what you're trying to do, and I think I just somehow would like some assurance that you are, in fact, going to address that question by regulation for those that are not covered by the Joint Commission.
We would be happy to have the letter of intent or whatever is the best way to go about doing that. We'd have no problem with that at all.
It does seem to make sense.
Because that's our plan.
Certainly.
Is
sure.
You know, and we hope by some of this that it will, I got a lot of hospital colleagues here, hope it will give some incentive for the facilities to become JCA accredited. You know, those smaller facilities, it's kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval type of thing. And so we want to try to put something out there that will give them an incentive to get the JCHA accreditation.
Senator Justice.
Thank you. I understand that it's a good housekeeping seal, and I can understand why it's a marketing tool, but there is a fee charged to the hospitals for that service. Do you charge for yours?
No, sir.
It naturally raises the question to a layman as to why a hospital association, especially small hospitals, would want to... add to their costs by having to pay for surveys when you're doing them for free.
That's why I think some of them have not asked for the surveys because of the expense of the survey.
But under this system,
and we don't want to force them into spending that money if they don't want to.
So under this system, and they would have that option. They could say, "We're not going to go through that process. You better come."
Sir.
Okay.
Are you finishing?
Yes.
Are there further questions or comments? Do you feel that it's necessary in any way for us to ensure that there are still our inspections of smaller hospitals to have any further wording in this? Or do you think it's protected enough with a letter of intent?
I think the letter of intent would protect it enough.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. You've often brought up the concern over regulations, and
we
would be implementing it by there, and yet on the other hand, it would take, you know, quite a bit of additional wording to change this so that, you know, you two different kinds out there are going to be treated differently.
Well, the reason I ask that question is that it does bother me. We spend a great deal of time and money in the regulatory process, and every time we answer request of a group or of the department, but we have more regulations promulgated and more expense and more time. So that if there is, you have now, do you not, existing regulations on your inspections? Then if you have existing regs, would it be necessary, is there some wording we could put in here that would eliminate the necessity for going through the whole reg process? Because certainly they wouldn't qualify as emergency regs. And that means, again, another whole series of hearings, of printings, and we're trying to cut costs. In trying to cut out one inspection, are we adding as much cost as here, it's $3,000 per hospital, are we adding $3,000 in new regs?
I don't believe so, Senator, because our current regs say annual. Our current regs say that we will do an annual survey. All we would do to our regs, I think, is indicate that in the case of those JCHA-accredited facilities, we would have the alternative to decide not to go in on any one particular year. And that would still, those regs still would be there, says annual, for those facilities that are not JCHA-accredited. So it's not even a regulatory change as far as the annual aspect is concerned. What we would be adding to the regulations, though, is the specifics of why we would want to go in there if they were JCHA accredited. Because even though they're JCHA accredited, we may still wish to go into that facility. Because a survey is really dependent upon the people doing the survey. And you can get some surveyors under JCHA that aren't as top-notch as you'd like to have. So you may get the feeling that you're not getting as good a survey. So we want the prerogative to go in there if that type of thing happens. And we will probably argue with the facilities in that area during the regulatory process as to how, when we decide to do that and when we don't decide to do that.
Well, is that a big enough deal that it couldn't be settled within the legislation proper? What we're trying to do in much of our legislation is eliminate the necessity for having to go through the reg process again. That way is one way we're sure that the intent of the legislation is carried out. and one way of trying to keep down administrative costs on that process. You see what I'm asking?
Yes, I see, yes. I guess the only answer is to write the bill more specific, and that often ends up getting rid of the flexibility.
That's true.
You know, you tie it down so tight that we're back to almost where we were.
Well, what's the difference if you tie it down so tight in a bill or tie it down so tight in regs? Because you can change your regs?
The industry and the department can change the regs after working with it some, you know, without going through the legislature. And sometimes it's tough to change it through the legislature.
Yeah, sometimes it's tough to change regs, too.
Yes, ma'am.
For us. Are there other comments or questions on part of this committee? Thank you very much. We'll take a brief pause while we get the sponsor out of another committee. Senator Faith,
Jim.
We have heard, in case you're interested, from both the Hospital Association and the department.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Jan Fakes. I represent South Anchorage Midtown in the State Senate. I apologize to the committee for not being here, just a miscommunication. I didn't realize the bill was up today, or if I did, it didn't sink in to the point where I understood it. So I do apologize for the inconvenience of the committee, and yet I'm pleased that the bill is before you. The bill is a relatively simple one. Have you heard about the amendment? Was the amendment...
Yes, we have prepared, Senator Fakes, a committee substitute that added the recommendations. We have not accepted that substitute as yet.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Well, I would ask the committee to consider that substitute and to give the Department of Health and Social Services a more flexible option in inspecting hospitals by removing the word manual. I think, or annual, excuse me, I think if you got down to requesting a fiscal note that this would be a money saver, and in a situation where...
We got a zero fiscal note, but it did not show... It should show probably a negative.
It definitely should show a negative, and maybe the committee could request another one, because there should be a savings here of inspections and time and state employees. And so I would hope the committee would consider this bill, allow the amendment that would allow the inspections from the Joint Committee on Accreditation of Hospitals. And I think we can let the private sector do some of these inspections and get their accreditation for the hospitals and get the state out of the hospital inspection business on a yearly basis, which is very expensive.
Senator, the question that came up, and I know it's very unfair to you that you weren't here, I had brought up the question of the amount of regulation change would take, and if there were any way that any of those necessary changes could be incorporated within the bill. I don't think I really got a response on that, other than that they can change regs and we said we can change the bill too. But we will of course see those regs as they are produced to make sure that this intent is carried out. One of the senators was worried that it did not relieve the state of their duty to inspect the small hospital that is not involved in the accreditation. Do any of you have questions of Jan? I think Faith's I brought up to date on.
Madam Chairman, if I may, you and I both agree that if we should write the law, and if it takes a little longer to write it right, then we should hold it and write it right, rather than just to allow the department to make up regulations and change regulations to meet something that they think we meant. And so if you want to look at it and take the time to look at the regulations and what changes would be required to see if there's possibly some changes we can incorporate in the bill in a HESC committee CS, I would have no objections to that. And I would help, my staff would help your staff in doing that. If you think that's necessary, I'd have no objections to it. Because what I have found that if we are going to do something like this, then we better be sure that the department has a clear understanding and that no one gets hurt in the end, that a hospital doesn't get left out there, not inspected, and that there isn't liability to the state.
Any comments or questions on part of the committee?
Madam Chair, I think that's great. You know, because I think there is a difference between those are inspected, the smaller hospitals tend not to be, and I don't think that was certainly not the intent of your legislation.
Absolutely not. That's what's always so nice about coming to a hearing with lots of different minds, because any little loophole that might be out there comes forth in a hearing, and
We don't, the idea is not to hurt people, so.
Then we will possibly ask again of the department, ask them to come back up while you're here so that we can pursue this question just a little bit and see what's necessary and see if there's anyone else that wishes to testify. Can you take a few minutes? Can you take another few minutes?
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Ogden, would you mind coming back up again and let's look at this thing? To what extent do you think that these, this four-line bill will change the regulatory or make necessary regulation? Or is that, do you need to look at it a little bit and get back to me on it? Is there anything in your mind that we could put in there that will not cast in concrete or take away some of your leeway that you're seeking, but will protect the small hospital and cause any doubts on the party and the committees to be wiped away?
The only thing that I can think of, Senator, would be in statute some type of language that would say that in the case of those facilities that were not JCHA accredited, the department would be required to do an annual licensing survey.
Intent, sir, or are you trying in the cases where you can through, you know, the three types of federal of inspection you already have to have, are you trying to eliminate any of those in this legislation?
Not in the case of facilities that do not have joint commission accreditation.
Mentioned. Mm-hmm. To pursue that point, in those cases where you have the three, I was having a little trouble before understanding how this legislation would necessarily impact that. I think we would want you, and I'm sure from your point of view of a service, you'd want to go out and combine those kinds of things. Are there barriers in the law now that prevent you from doing that? If there are, we should be addressing those, because that seems to me so logical.
Yes, no. The only barrier that we've had to it is that word annual that was in the current statute. You see, the federal requirements are that we do these surveys annually. And our problem has been to get the coordination of our licensing survey and our inspection of care surveys all at one time.
Well, Madam Chair, let's pursue that. If we have, since we have the two hospitals, we have the joint accreditation and we have the others,
right.
If we would come back with wording that would call for a continuation of the annual inspections and investigations, does that prevent you from getting this other portion coordinated then?
It does, unless we can, I was trying to think of how we can somehow change the annual years to be the years that we do the federal survey. See, that's our problem. We've got on
how
this treadmill.
How often is the federal survey? I understood that was annually.
That's
every other year? Or?
Yes. And see, they require, if we don't stay on their federal annual surveys that we've got each facility set up on, we're liable for federal penalty with an actual loss of federal dollars.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems like we need the request of them and a way that we can get it on. I think that's the intent. Are you getting off of that because of the numbers that you've had to do so you just can't keep up to a schedule? By our changing and taking some footing to it, the joint accreditation, are we freeing you up so that you're going to be able to keep on a schedule to fit into those federal mandates?
Yes. The bill, by letting us not have to do a survey in a facility that's joint accredited, mm-hmm. you are freeing us up to be able to do some of the other demands of our time. Mm-hmm. And by taking the word annual out would allow us to then get all of our surveys coordinated together. And we're getting closer and closer to that. I don't want you to think that we can't pull it off sooner or later. We can, even with the word annual in here. The main thing we were trying to get with this statute was the ability to not have to go in and bother those facilities that we know are already up to standard and have been up to standard for a number of years, mm-hmm. and that way reduce our workload.
Sure.
That's really what we were trying to get to.
Good. Well, that's really what we're trying to help you do.
Yeah, I know. I feel that, and I think it's just the wordsmithing that we need to get, you know, down to, and I don't have the words for you right now. I'd be happy to go away and try to put together some words for you with Dennis's help and get back to you.
And the sponsor's help.
And the sponsor's help.
Senator Farrakhan, just out of curiosity, in the years that this process has been going on,
Have the inspections ever found conditions which required action by the department or correction?
Yes, sir. Hmm?
Yes, sir.
I mean, is it like a punch list of minor things, or have you found any major deficiencies?
No, I don't mean... We like to think, at least, that we had something to do with some of the facilities being able to get new money and build new facilities because we found them inadequate. The quality of care has always been good in this state. It's the physical facility that we've had more trouble with than anything else, and we think we've had some impact in that area.
Well, just the sponsor has said that we don't want to hurt people. I think we all agree with that. Is there any possibility that a small facility or even a large facility might have the attitude, well, the inspector was just here, the examiner was just here, and we would have a kind of laxness set in until the next round if it's not an annual inspection?
Be a big mistake, because patients write us letters and say, please go inspect. And we do. We unannounced go in and inspect when we get a patient complaint. And they all know that.
I know a restaurant I'm going to be writing about.
Hi there, for the question. Then, sir, would you... with the permission of the sponsor, we will hold this till our next meeting and have it before us. I hope by that time, can we get together very quickly? Yes.
With wordsmithing, I like that.
Yes, wordsmithing is very good. For our benefit of this wordsmithing that we were going to do, is there a need for us to adopt the committee substitute, or let's just come in with a new one and not have to have a committee substitute or a committee substitute? Very well, we'll leave that then as is.
Staff, just like to call him on this.
Oh, that's 140?
Yeah.
He's on. No. No, that's the right time. Yes. The next bill before us is Senate Bill 140, relating to the rights of the terminally ill. The sponsor is Senator Eliason. He's on his way here now. Most of you, I think, you have your backup material and are fairly well familiar. We do have a proposed amendment that will be coming up, so... while we wait for Senator Eliason, do any of you have questions concerning the one we're going to be hearing now, or the amendment, or shall we just wait for the testimony?
Madam Chair, I'm ready to wait for the testimony.
Oh, before we do that, I apologize. Was there anyone else here to speak to Senate Bill 45? Certainly don't want to miss anyone. Very well. Then Senate Bill 140 is before us. Who do we have to testify now?
Is he coming?
We are having our problems today. Sir, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Get my notes together here. I'd like to read a statement pertaining to Senate Bill 140. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you in support of Senate Bill 140, an act relating to the rights of the terminally ill. This legislation recognizes the right of a competent adult to refuse life-prolonging procedures if that adult is terminally ill. Medical capabilities to sustain life have increased dramatically in recent years. The ability to artificially extend the lives of the terminally ill when there is no cure in sight has led to a tragic confrontation between medical technology and the needs of the dying patient. Right to life laws, such as Senate Bill 140, are a much-needed response to this conflict. The intent behind this legislation is to establish and protect each individual's right to a dignified death without unnecessary medical treatment, which serves only to prolong the dying. This legislation does not condone mercifully, but recognizes the right of each individual to control his or her own death. The passage of this legislation would free physicians and other medical personnel from any liability from honoring a patient's written request. The proposed law is based on a discussion draft being considered by the National Conference of Commissioners on uniform state laws and provides for the following activities. One, it establishes a mechanism for individuals to decide in advance that you do not want heroic measures to prolong dying. Two, it gives immunity to physicians or health professionals who act in accordance with this law. It guarantees that patient is hopeless and irreversibly terminally conditioned before a declaration is considered, and only when the patient has can communicate with the patient physician does this declaration become effective. Excuse me, I just kept rushing in here. In 1984, 23 states have passed similar legislation, and many other legislatures have such a bill under consideration. I think in your pamphlet you'll find that, as far as the West Coast goes, in California in 1976, this bill was passed. The states of Idaho and Oregon in 1977, and the state of Washington in 1979. I think, Madam Chair, that I would like to also read a statement I received out of some of the literature in support of this type of legislation. It goes something like this. Death in the right circumstances is both right and our right. If we have lived to the fullest of our capacities, dying is merely suspension within a mystery. If our lives have served, have seemed wasted or futile, death is more reprieve than reprimand. Believing this, we should not be intimidated or thwarted by the counterarguments of the state, the church, the law, society, or medicine itself. We have heard them all, but the final choice must be ours. And a comment by the governor of New York. It says, like it or not, we are increasingly involved in life and death questions to which we have no consistent response, no consistent response. Science is leaving us in the dust. So, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure what the reception of this particular bill will be. I think it needs the benefit of public testimony. I think that we should, number one, hear from the legal community what the ramifications of that particular portion would be, and certainly from the medical community, and also from those interested people who might support or oppose the bill. So to the present time, I've received very little correspondence relating to the introduction of the bill. I'm hoping that during this particular exchange, we'll be able to maybe satisfy the concerns of a lot of people. I think it's a very delicate subject, but I think it needs public exposure. So at this particular time, that is the main purpose of this bill, to bring it before the legislature and the public as a whole to see what the feelings of the people are.
Madam Chair, just a very brief comment. I signed as a co-sponsor for many of the same reasons that Senator Eliason gave, and people have brought up this subject over a period of time. It's a very difficult one to handle. Obviously, there is a trend in, throughout the lower 48, and I think interest here, but I think it would be good if we could hear from, say, members of the legal and medical fraternity, simply to see if the bill is in good order and meets the needs so that it's not, you know, subject to litigation and problems. I think to hold out the hope of this and then put someone in jeopardy because of it would be a very difficult thing.
I'm in agreement with that. Senator, we have in the bill the definition, we don't have a definition of terminal condition. And I notice, well, we have death within a short time, but I noticed in a lot of other states it reads death is imminent. Do you have any preference on that?
I think that those types of determinations are going to have to be, we're going to have to probably get the advice from the medical community how they would interpret it, that particular provision. I think there's, as I say, I think the issue should be addressed by all of us, and I'm certainly willing to look at what the medical community defines as terminally ill, and also what the legal community has to say about those ramifications. But I'd just like to emphasize the fact that this is not does not condone mercy killing at all. It's far from doing that. I think it's more what you call your own rights. I think it's more along those lines.
Another question that comes to mind is Section 1 would allow the declaration be signed by another at the direction of the declarer. Do you feel that that needs any further guidelines, or should we pursue that with legal and the medical professionals.
Madam Chair, which section is that?
That's in section one, where it allows the declaration to be signed by another rep that declares correction.
Line
16, 17.
I would like to have the attorneys address that particular point. But there are some, Madam Chair, if I may, but also the definition of a competent adult is not defined in this particular bill, but there could be some language inserted relative to an competent adult at least the age of 18 years of age, as we do require on the affidavit.
I notice there's barriers here, so we can pursue that as
yes.
we go then. Are there further questions from members of the committee or comments? Senator, will you be able to stay with us for a while as we go through this then, and we'll hear from others that are here? We have quite a number, so your hope that we get this discussed, I think, will be seen today. Mary Townsmeyer. Mary, if you'd identify yourself a little better.
Okay. Appreciate any guidance you give me. I've never done anything like this before. My name is Mary Townsmeyer, and I'm the clinical coordinator of Hospice of Juneau here in Juneau, Alaska. And as far as comments go, I would like to put them, I think, into three blocks of comments. I contacted Hospice of Seattle, Hospice of Anchorage in Anchorage, and I asked them if they had a copy of the bill, if they had reviewed it, and if they had any comments that they would like me to present for them today. And they returned that with a phone call, and they gave three comments, and I don't know if they're technical and those are the kinds of things that you want to address at this time or not.
Yes.
Yes.
Any comments ahead?
Okay. Their comments are on page 1, line 29. They felt that clarity was questionable here, and that the time should be specified by the person who declares.
That what should be specified?
Time. Is what they're having.
Oh, you mean rather than a relatively
short time, it should be
specified.
A specified time. Page 2, line 9. They wondered whether or not a proxy could sign in place of the patient's signature.
As I understand this bill, it does not. Only for someone at the direction. Over your dead
body. I agree.
I guess I can address that to the sponsor. Was that your intention?
It's not intent. It's this document is directed to you by.
Let's see, what was that again? Page 5.
Page 5, line 25 through 26. This chapter does not condone, authorize, or approve mercy killing or euthanasia.
We're supposed to be the same, but we'll look it up. Are there any other specifics?
No, that was from Hospice of Anchorage.
Well, on the bill in general, did they seem to be generally supportive, against, pro, con? Was there any indication?
Supportive.
Madam Chair, do you know, and perhaps Senator Lassen knows, in this kind of legislation, you mentioned time limit. Is there a period of time after which the declaration is stale and not effective in those states where this is adopted? I'm thinking of the situation where someone at age 21 thinks this is a wonderful idea and signs a declaration, and at age 75 becomes terminally ill and may have a different philosophy about
it. If you'll allow me, I'll refer to Mr. Barry on that. I think we've had some discussions along that.
All right.
None of the states I know have a time limit on it. The time limit creates some very definite problems. Being aware of expiration, et cetera, et cetera. It, of course, could be revoked at any time.
If at age 75, then the lady or gentleman who had signed it decided they didn't like it, they could revoke it immediately. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Does that answer your question?
Well, you mentioned they may not remember the time limit. They may not remember they made the declaration either. Isn't that true?
Then my question is, I just today received a copy of Oncology Times. Oncology means cancer. Times, and there was an article about lawmakers' proposed uniformity in natural death legislation. And I was wondering if this draft was that uniform act that they're proposing, or is that something that you all want more information on? I copied the article, and it's two pages, and they're not stapled together. To see if that was something that you wanted.
Mr. Barrier, would you like to address that?
Madam Chair, this at the moment has not been adopted by the National Conference Commissioners on Uniform State Law. However, this is the draft that will be before them for adoption, and that, with permission of the executive, that has been presented to various legislatures. This is the act that the article is referring to.
Okay, because they're talking about a card that goes in the wallet, like a organ donor card that actually goes into your wallet. You know, just.
Were there further questions, Mary? Or?
Yeah, there are. Okay. Yesterday, James Spear, a lawyer and, my understanding, PhD in medical ethics, was here in Juneau and spoke. And I asked him about what he saw from his point of view, what his feelings were, etc., about this law. And he said, number one, that he thought it was very important and et cetera, that legislatures and people are interested in talking about these issues. He thought that was very important and very supportive to the issues. But his concern was the opposite of the uniform law. He felt that local communities needed to identify what their current problems were and that the bills had to be tailored to meet these local needs. Or statewide needs, as the bill was. He also mentioned that he thought that it was interesting that the bill does not become effective until the patient is no longer able to communicate, and that the patient is proclaimed or diagnosed as terminal by their physician. And in the bill, it says that if a physician states that a patient is terminal and is not going to adhere to the wishes of the patient, then he is committing a misdemeanor. And he was questioning that issue, you know. Let's see what else he said.
Well, Madam Chair, is there in medical ethics any problem with that? In other words, are we making criminal something which some physicians feel that they are bound by their oath to do? You see what I'm saying, Senator?
Well, all I can respond to that, Senator, is I see Mary shaking her head no, but we have contacted the Medical Association. I don't think there's anyone here, is there? So,
Dr. Frazier's here.
Oh, well, Dr. Frazier's here, and we expect his testimony. But of those contacted, Dr. Frazier is here with glasses. Maybe he could tell us something about that. Mary, did you have further comments?
Yeah, he also stated that he said when you're dealing with the term terminal, he thought that it was interesting in one study. Once again, this is Mr. Spear. Said that in one study that they did, they asked extremely competent physicians of 20, 30 years practice in their given specialty to review patients' charts and then give a prognosis, a time of death, I guess. And they said that, he said that it was considered an accurate guess if the patient died 1 month before or after that. And he said the accuracy rate in that particular study was 19%. And I think that's information, you know, that should be brought forth. He suggested contacting other states to see what problems or what solutions this bill has provided for other states. Personally, personal experience now. Now I'm talking for Mary Tonsmeyer. The issue came forth for us in hospice a few times. When we, in hospice, when we're caring for patients in the home, this isn't really an issue. Extraordinary means to maintain life in the home generally are not compatible things. So, but when we admit our patients to the hospital setting, when our patients and family choose the hospital setting for the place of death, then the hospital nurses are directed by the guidelines of the hospital that they must resuscitate, they must do cardiac pulmonary resuscitation unless directed by the physician to do otherwise. And when this has come to be a problem, I did contact Seattle and ask them who in Seattle would be the best person to talk to regarding this problem. And that was a year ago, and I spoke to Alma Sanford at Providence Hospital in Seattle. And she said that one of the problems that they had found in Seattle, or an issue, I shouldn't address it as a problem, an issue that they found in Seattle was that in their oncology clinics, they had patients coming into the clinic on a daily basis or for a period of time over when they're undergoing radiation, chemotherapy, et cetera. And then this will go on for 1 year, 2 year, 3 year period of time. And they had a stack of living wills or natural death acts there with information beside it. And this individual walks by this pile for a 2 year period of time and never chooses to lift one up and fill one out. Later is admitted to the hospital, is in a comatose state, cannot speak for himself, and the staff is placed in the position of, did his never picking it up mean that he didn't want it? Did it mean that he just wasn't emotionally ready to deal with it? I would say that, I would generally say that the closer people come to these issues of death, I think your statement about someone 21 is much more apt to fill out a living will than someone 80. You know, I just really believe that to be a general truth. The closer we are to those situations, the less comfortable we are with the situation. I'm not trying to...
I've got a problem there, Mary, in that many of us have had some experience with loved ones. And in all the times that I went with my husband to clinics, I never once picked up anything around the clinic to read, and it wasn't, nor did he. And it wasn't because we weren't interested in it. We're not there for reading.
Right.
We're there for treatment and because someone's ill. And I don't know how many of you pick up stuff in the doctor's office to read other than a magazine? May I see a show of hands? Three, four. Okay, so that might be part of the answer.
Well, that might be a way that the staff wasn't looking at it. The staff was looking at it that they
that
had...
That just brings that question to my mind, because usually, of course, maybe I'm different. I'm writing letters and...
Senator, if I may, I wanted to ask you, I appreciate, and I think the committee does, the work you've done in preparing for this hearing. You mentioned the 19% figure as an accuracy figure. Were those cases where the conditions that are met here existed, that is where there was not only a diagnosis of terminal condition, but that the patient was not able to make decisions? Or, I mean, those would...
That was a study for a whole different purpose.
So if you had, I would assume that if you had those, that combination of circumstances, an unconscious or heavily sedated patient in a diagnosed terminal condition, probably the accuracy would be much higher than 19%.
I would think that you would be right.
I don't know who I should ask this question to, perhaps Senator Eliason, but I'm wondering whether in any jurisdictions, maybe Bill knows, the responsibility is shared, that is a second physician has to be consulted or a second opinion has to be obtained.
Mr. Barry?
Madam Chairman, yes, in several jurisdictions that is shared. That was debated rather extensively at the committee meeting. Incidentally, I'm the liaison member of the draft committee, and was at the meeting in Hartford that prepared the final draft. And the problem was brought up, and what highly relevant to Alaska is the fact that the second opinion is frequently
in relatively small communities impossible to get, and you've created real difficulties in small communities for that requirement.
Does that
answer
you so far?
Well,
Harry, you had more.
No.
I
mean, there's an assumption that you're going to have a lot of situations where the terminal patient is being sustained on sophisticated machinery in a small hospital, and I don't know if that's true or not, whether by that time the patient has been shipped to some medical center more often than
that. It was brought up particularly by a member of the committee from Wyoming, where they apparently did have that problem. It sounded relevant. The description sounded relevant to you.
And then the only other thing that Mr. Spear mentioned, two other things that he mentioned, was he called it the Goldilocks syndrome. He said one of the problems that individuals have, and I don't know if there's room in the bill for it, is he said that most of us want, we don't want too much and we don't want too little, so we want something in between. And he says this in-between area sometimes becomes quite large and just as vague as where we're at right now. That was Mr. Spear of yesterday's comment. And the other thing he brought up was that $1 billion a day are spent on health care every day in this country. $1 billion are spent in this area. And he says of that, 42% is on individuals who are in the last 15 days of their life. And he said, is that where this legislation is coming from, or are we truly looking at the rights of the terminally ill?
Madam Chair, I'm a professional.
No, I'm not saying, but he's talking about nationwide and that the bill is, you know, across the United States.
Well, if I remember correctly, I'm also co-sponsor on this. I was not looking at money as much as I was looking at my own self. I don't want to lay there.
I know. I feel the same way. It seemed really a wonderful idea to me. And when I called Seattle a year ago, I thought that's what we need in this state. And then after speaking with them, it sounded like it helped, possibly in some cases, but it did bring up other problems. And that's
so
all
does every piece of legislation.
Yes.
Thank you.
Of course, I don't quite agree with you. I think the older you get, the more interested you are in this type of legislation. Speaking from that advantage point. But you were mentioning about people checking in and out of the clinic, and I suspect some are getting progressively worse. When the diagnosis is going down, they're going to, you know, they know that they're a very serious condition. You feel a reluctance, have you ever had the patients express any reluctance to you that they really don't want to check in the hospital because then they lose control of their own liberties, so to speak, that they can control up to what by going to the clinic, but once they have in, then responsibility and their civil rights are turned over to someone else. And consequently, they won't go to the hospital.
Yes, I agree with you. But I found that the majority of families that I've worked with, and I've only worked with 50 families here in Juneau, but I found that the majority of ones that I dealt with that went into the hospital, and not all 50 went into the hospital, only a small percentage of them did, were not aware of this issue of code, that it wasn't even brought to their knowledge base, that once in the hospital, that they had to have this order on their chart stating no code. So that's my personal experience, is that most individuals are not aware of it. And once brought aware of it, then they make the decisions.
Well, that's an answer to my question, or not? What order? What code? You're using?
Oh, I say no code, no resuscitation, no extraordinary. You know, when someone dies in a hospital, an arrest is called, and a team of individuals comes and begins resuscitating, and that happens unless there is something written on the patient's chart that says, do not resuscitate or do not code patient.
Yeah, Senator, in your testimony, you're talking about cardiac arrest situations, but this bill would apply to the cancer victim with a healthy heart, I suppose, isn't that right?
The cancer victim is either going to stop breathing, which is a pulmonary arrest, or his heart is going to stop, which is a cardiac arrest. You know, the cause of it is not the same as the cause of a heart attack. You know, what's causing the arrest is not the same, but it's still an arrest.
This legislation would permit, would not this legislation permit a treatment decision to be made not to use life-sustaining procedures before you reach that stage of heart failure?
Yes. And that, you know, in essence...
And that's done now.
Yeah, I mean, in essence, that decision is made not uniformly, but it is made when someone is admitted to the hospital and their physician goes to them and says, you know, how much intervention do you want in your care?
When our Senator Bierenkamp mentions that it's being done now, is it being done now without legal authority in Alaska? Is it being done now by physicians without legal authority in Alaska?
Senator Justin, the decision between the physician and the patient's family is one of discussion in the durable terminal situation. So that the decision in that situation is between the physician and the patient's family. This often poses a dilemma for the family who have feelings of guilt and say, oh, we can't let and die, and they cannot make that decision. This bill offers the individual, during the time when he is in possession of his faculties, and the opportunity of making this decision, and in a way relieving his family of a very difficult situation.
Well, but I want to pursue this, Madam Chair, on a sort of a...
I noticed that.
Right, too. kind of basis. I mean... that's fine and dandy, but under the present circumstances, if a physician and the family concur that life-sustaining efforts should be suspended, there's no penalty for that, either ethically or in the criminal law, correct?
Correct.
Now, under the bill, we would create a misdemeanor if the physician fails. We offer patients or people the opportunity to make the declaration. Then if the patient, if you've made the declaration and you're in that situation where life-sustaining procedures are used and you are terminal and you are unable to participate and the declaration has been recorded, a physician who fails to honor that declaration is guilty of a misdemeanor. But we never say anywhere, either now or in this proposal, that if you don't make the declaration, now we have the option of the declaration or no declaration. If you don't make the declaration and the physician decides not to use life-sustaining procedures, that is criminal. I mean, why shouldn't...
Good Lord.
I think the dilemma, Senator...
Well, I'm looking... Pardon?
The role of the physician is to preserve life. He can... And frequently the question arises in intensive care and a very expensive situation. And the physician regards it as a hopeless outcome, but his role is to preserve life. Hence, I think there's significant contribution to prolongation of life beyond the time when it could be maintained naturally, prolongation of life by artificial respiration and so forth. Because this is a physician's role.
Yeah. Well, so the only point I want to make, I won't belabor it, believe it or not, but the only point I want to make is that if we're going to give people the control over their destinies, and we're going to say that if you make a declaration in which you signify that you don't want life-sustaining procedures if you're terminally ill and can't speak to the issue at the time, that's fine. But then we ought to honor the other side of the coin if they implicitly or explicitly say, I do want life-sustaining procedures. That's okay.
Madam Chair, I think under Section 1812.080, under D, I think pretty well covers that. Or presumption made if it chooses not to make a declaration. So, wouldn't that cover that particular question?
Well, except that we don't have any authority now for mercy killing, and it happens.
Oh, I think so. You're using the term mercy killing very loosely there. if a family decides that they've had enough and there's no chance, I don't see that as a mercy killing at all. That's quite different.
That isn't apt.
Am I wrong, Doctor? Isn't there a difference there?
Yeah, you were correct.
See, there we go with the family guilt situation again. Immediately, my hackles are up. Here we go. Mary, did you have more that you wanted to say? Are there some... Are you sorry you ever saw us, Mary?
Still
in
your mind.
You did very good.
Well, Dr. Fraser, if you haven't already completed your testimony, would you please join us up here? We don't mean to be treating the subject lightly, but I guess it gets so serious with all of us that... It's like an accident. Once you see you're not dead, first inclination is to laugh. You got out of it.
Thank you very much, Senator Fahrenkamp and members of the committee. You have the position papers from the department. Would you wish me to go over this and
just briefly, if you would, please.
The department recognizes the right of the competent individual to decide whether life-sustaining procedures should be used in the face of terminal illness or injury. And this is an issue that's received a lot of attention, and other states, as has been mentioned in previous testimony, have been taking measures similar to this bill to permit the individual, the competent individual, to participate in decisions regarding his or her care when afflicted with a terminal condition. The bill really permits a competent adult to execute a declaration declaring the withholding or withdrawal of life-sustaining measures. And the Department of Health and Social Services supports the bill. I'd like to make some comments on the dilemma of the physician in this situation. Physicians cannot, nor do they wish to be placed in the position of condoning or participating in euthanasia, in mercy killing. So that the dilemma then in the healthcare system is the physician team is involved in caring for a patient with terminal illness, and he's called upon to utilize all of the scientific technology which permits really the preservation of life from the standpoint of breathing and cardiac activity for almost an indefinite period of time. Now, this has contributed significantly to costs, to interference with the individual, and many people have expressed the desire that when they're terminally ill, they do not want this interference on the part of medical technology in prolonging their life, and I personally subscribe to that. So that the decision then is made in two ways. One, the individual, this approach, which this law permits the physicians, the hospital to avoid the introduction of life-preserving techniques in a terminal situation which are prolonging the event, and to give the individual the ability to participate in this decision. It is true now that frequently the decision is made by the family. If the physician is left alone to the decision, then morally he must use whatever means are available to preserve life. This is his role. The alternative to this is what's presently being done, and that is the physician works with the family, and the family makes the decision. The family says, well, I know that Uncle Joe didn't want any heroic activities, and we'd appreciate it if you did not use heroic resuscitation in the terminal situation. So this bill then adds another spectrum. It permits the individual to make a decision. And that's very comforting to many families.
Paul. Mr. Chairman, I have a question. When we talk about life-sustaining procedures, is surgery considered one within that category?
Conceivably, yes. Now, the situation that I can see a number of situations. For example, a person who has, stomach cancer. He has metastasis to various organs. His ultimate prognosis is extremely poor. He becomes obstructed in his intestinal tract. It is possible by surgery to relieve that and perhaps to prolong his life for a period of weeks or days. In that situation, it may be. And in general, if the patient is competent and alert, that decision would be presented to the patient. He'd say, "No, I've had, I do not wish it, or I do."
Senator, further.
Yeah, I guess let me give you a little case. This is a true case, so I'm not just drawing this up. The years are different. But let's assume in 1975, this person had brain cancer. They were diagnosed as 1 to 2 years to live. Now, this is back in 75. Okay, now it's 1985. At that time, he had signed off, the declaration. Now it's 1985. For some reason, he goes into a coma. Surgery is necessary. It's something to do. Okay, so we need some brain surgery, but we don't know whether this surgery is going to allow that person to have another year, 2 years, 5 years. It's going to put an awful burden on that physician, is it not? Because, first of all, the prognosis was 1 to 2 years. Here it is already 10 years later. But now you have to go and do some surgery, but you're not sure whether that person will gain sanity again or what. Would that legally put the surgeon in some kind of a bind to make that decision?
I think the critical question that you raised is it was not known whether the surgery would be effective or not. So in that situation, in the judgment of the physician, I would think that this is not a heroic effort to preserve life. This is a diagnosis, a coma, an acute condition. Now, it might be at the time of surgery that it was recognized that he would not survive. And then I think following surgery, the decision would be made relative to the declaration not to use heroic efforts.
So probably, Madam Chairman, that the surgery would occur.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there further questions, comments? Had you finished, Dr.
Frisch? I finished. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hate to seem to be rushing, but our time is going by. Dennis DeWitt, Alaska Hospital Association.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Dennis DeWitt, President of the Dennis DeWitt, President of the Alaska State Hospital Association. I suddenly, with Senator Eliason's comments, found myself feeling like the elder citizen or the elder statesman around here. In 1975 and 76, I worked very closely with Senator, then Assemblyman, State Assemblyman Barry Keene in California on the Natural Death Act in California, which was the first one enacted in the United States. And it was through now Senator Keene that I first met Senator Eliason. It had escaped me until you mentioned that 76 was the year it happened. There are a number of things that are changing in healthcare. Our position is to support the bill and to ask for one amendment on the liability and immunity issues. But there's a changing impression of what healthcare ought to be and who ought to have input. The patient wants more and more input in the decision-making process. It's our view that this piece of legislation moves in that direction. I could share with you that when I was in California, there was much consternation about it. It was interesting to observe the attorney, the physician, and a member of the family having a discussion on the very principles that this is to address. And in fact, there are no answers, I'm afraid. However, with the level of concern that there was in California, it's my recollection, and I have been observing the legal literature lately on a different issue related to this, that there have not been legal problems that have occurred as a result of the enactment of this particular type of statute in the state of California. My recollection, I'm not an attorney, and I only read some of the healthcare law. When this was first introduced, the first thing I did was check with some of my friends and colleagues in California to find out whether, during the last 5 years since I've been up here, there had been any change in what had happened on this. And the reports that I had was that there had not been, that it had pretty well settled out as an issue. The comfort level had increased in terms of receiving the declaration and acting on it. That's not a definitive statement as to where it is, but the sensitivity that I was able to gather in some very quick surveying of colleagues who are living under this particular type of legislation. The suggestion we would have for an amendment would be on page 4, line 10, which grants a particular immunity to physicians. What we would suggest is that health facilities be added to that section. It's my understanding that it's questionable whether or not that offers any particular liability, but it does in fact increase our comfort level. And it's my understanding that it does absolutely no damage to the bill. So in that context, we would submit and request that such an amendment be adopted. Time is passing and you have many other issues on your agenda. There are a number of other comments, a personal experience with reference to the legislation I can make, but I'll stop here, offer to respond, Madam Chairman, to any questions, and suggest that it is my experience that it's been a fairly positive step in terms of raising comfort level is between the hospital community, the physician community, the legal community, and the families that are involved.
Are there questions or comments on part of the... Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you very
much. Uh-oh, I'm going to mess this up. Sid?
Heidersdorf.
Right. Thank you. Laskins for life.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sid Heidersdorf. I'm representing Alaskans for Life. Senate Bill 140 is living will legislation similar to so-called Death with Dignity and Natural Death Acts proposed in many state legislatures across the country. We are opposed to legislation of this kind for a number of reasons. First of all, we clearly recognize that patients already have the fundamental right of self-determination in the acceptance or rejection of treatment. Physicians have for years in every state of the union removed extraordinary life-sustaining procedures in consultation with the family or the patient, and they have done so without threat. If individual cases of abuse crop up, they should be handled under existing law. We believe that this legislation is a result of a number of highly publicized special hard cases, and as such, we think this is bad law to make a law for those specific cases. So basically, we do not see a need for this legislation. We do not argue with the stated goals of the bill. We recognize the basic right of the patient to refuse the use of devices to prolong life when death is imminent. We also believe it is healthy for people to think about their death and to prepare for it. Our opposition to Senate Bill 140 stems from a number of different directions, and it is really based on the manner in which it attempts to achieve its goals. We believe it will cause havoc in the physician-patient relationship and other potential harm that legislation of this kind may bring with it. First of all, the physician-patient relationship. It implies that a patient must claim his fundamental right by legal action in advance in the form of signing a directive to ensure that this right is respected. We believe this is a dangerous precedent. These laws promote the notion that the physician has some independent or inherent right where the patient is concerned and may treat him even if unasked or opposed. In reality, the physician can take no action unless the patient or family explicitly or implicitly gives the physician permission. When a person engages a doctor's services, he does not abdicate his right to decide his own fate. For the majority of the physicians, there is no confusion on this point, and there's no widespread abuse of this right, which indicates the need for this kind of law. We are concerned about the idea that a patient must sign a directive to have his rights respected. Once the right to refuse treatment is construed as conferred by the state, the implication is that the state can control this decision relating to death. What the state gives, it also can take away. And in this view, if this view is accepted, the state could also presumably make a decision as to when the patient should die. Now, this sounds far-fetched at this time, but this brings us to the brink of active euthanasia. It is well known that advocates of mercy killing strongly support this kind of legislation. The Euthanasia Society of America, which recently changed its name to the Society for the Right to Die Incorporated, is one of the prime sponsors and promoters of this legislation nationwide. The next issue we're concerned about is the rights of the non-signers. Senator Josephson brought this issue up. We feel strongly about this. What happens to those who do not sign a living will? The logical presumption is that those who do not sign it do not have the same claim to self-determination as to those individuals who do sign it. Will the physician feel free to remove life-sustaining devices in the case of the non-signer? If the answer is yes, then the bill is clearly unnecessary. If the answer is no, then the bill obviously creates as much mischief as it resolves, since it is reasonable to assume that the majority of the people will not sign a living will. The majority will then have their fundamental rights undermined by a law such as this. Living will legislation could have the opposite effect to that desired by the sponsors. Those with wills may be undertreated, since there is no penalty for removing or denying care. It is overtreatment that the law seeks to remedy. What about those who do not sign the living will? Since these people did not exercise what is considered necessary, they may expect that they will be overtreated since the patient made no expression of a desire not to have life-sustaining means removed. The living will may cause a physician to hesitate to recommend steps his judgment prior to the law would have dictated. Out of all of this, we feel that one thing is certain: the living will legislation will not promote good judgment on the part of the physician, nor will it increase or promote better medical care. Another issue, dealing with the family. In cases where the patient cannot speak for himself, the family knows best the wishes of the patient. It is important to note that this legislation would effectively eliminate the families of both the signers and non-signers alike. It will exclude the non-signers, since not signing a living will could be interpreted as saying that the patient wants extraordinary care to be kept alive regardless of what members of the family say. Consent. A fundamental right of the patient is to be fully informed about medical procedures so he can give informed consent. Signing a living will is the ultimate in uninformed consent. The state should not permit this kind of practice. How can a patient make a decision regarding the circumstances of his death 5, 10, or 20 years in advance? He does not know the facts or circumstances that will exist at the time of his death. He will probably not even know the physician, since it is estimated that only 25% of the population has a family doctor. Even if the patient does know the physician, how does he know the physician will interpret, for example, life-sustaining procedures in the same manner as he? And in the definition of life-sustaining procedures, I really am not going to comment much on specific portions of the bill, but that definition is given there. I noticed earlier in testimony references were made to heroic efforts to save one's life, references made to extraordinary procedures. This bill doesn't speak of that at all. This bill only says life-sustaining procedure means a medical procedure or intervention that, when administered to a qualified patient, will serve only to prolong the dying process. I think it was about 2 years ago that an effort was made to define and antibiotics as falling under the category of medical intervention. And the purpose behind that was to deny antibiotics of the severely retarded individuals who would die then from infection. I believe the state was Florida where this occurred. The point is that would we consider antibiotics a life-sustaining procedure? Under this definition, I would say one could argue that point, and one could find themselves on the brink of getting into circumstances which the bill says, we're not talking about mercy killing or euthanasia, but you can get some of these things approved under poor definitions, and I think that's a problem with legislation of this type. In no other area of human activity would we consider a decision of this magnitude reasonable if made in such a factual vacuum. Signing a living will is truly an uninformed decision. Finally, presumably the purpose of the bill is to protect the rights of either the patient or the physician or both. While we do not accept the need for this bill, its goals can be accomplished without jeopardizing the rights of non-signing patients simply by passing a law which recognizes that patients have the right to make decisions and to restate the principle that extraordinary life-sustaining measures may be withdrawn by the attending physician when done under the usual and customary standards of medical practice after consultation with the family if that's necessary. This approach would avoid the difficulty of definitions. There would be no requirement for signing a directive affirming one's rights, and consequently no injury to those who do not sign, and there would be no pitfalls and potential for serious abuse that exists in living will legislation. I think we could easily see the situation where in nursing homes, elderly people would be put under pressure to sign these things. It would be very easy to convince an elderly person, I think, in some circumstances, to sign this kind of a living will. In conclusion, then, we believe this